Welcome to The Deep Dive, the show where we sift through mountains of information to bring you the most valuable nuggets, all curated just for you. Today, we're jumping into a really, really fascinating period of American history. Think about it before all the highways, the railroads, just this vast, untamed American wilderness. And figuring out how to navigate that, well, that fell to some incredibly daring people.
Yeah.
The Pathfinders.
That's right. And these weren't, you know, just weekend adventurers. They were serious explorers, trappers, traders, the ones who literally started drawing the map of the West. You've got names everyone knows, like Meriwether Lewis and William Clark heading all the way out to the Pacific, or Zebulon Pike's Peak, right? Still famous. But today we're really diving deep into one specific group, a legendary group, the Mountain Men, people like Jim Bridger, Kit Carson, guys who were, in a way, the architects of the Wild West.
Yeah, and what makes this whole era so compelling, I think, is that it wasn't just about adventure into some, you know, empty land. It was this huge collision of worlds. You had these encounters with native tribes, sometimes amazing cultural exchange, but also, sadly, really devastating conflict.
Exactly. So our mission today, really, is to unpack the stories of these trailblazers.
Mm-hmm.
Especially the Mountain Men. They just embodied this rugged, wild freedom that really shaped how America expanded westward. We've looked at historical accounts, journals, even modern analysis to try and get the clearest picture.
Okay, so let's get into it. Where do we start? How did this westward gaze even begin?
Well, you got to go back, way back. Think about those first tiny European settlements scattered along the Atlantic coast. Spanish San Augustine, French Port Royal, Jamestown, Quebec, the Dutch in Manhattan, the Pilgrims, just little footholds, really. They were mostly just focused on surviving, clinging to the edge of this massive continent.
Right, just trying to make it work. So they weren't immediately thinking, let's cross the continent.
Not at all, not initially. But after a bunch of colonial wars, Britain basically took control of the eastern part of temperate America. Then, after the Revolution, you have this new, energetic American population, and they start spreading out westward. The climate was good, and maybe compared to French or Spanish areas, there was sometimes less initial organized resistance from certain tribes. It allowed them to push inland.
And that's where that famous line comes in, right? Bishop Berkeley's Westward the Course of Empire Takes Its Way, even though he wrote it way before the U.S. was even a thing.
Precisely. And, you know, pretty soon Americans reach the Mississippi River. They start transforming these old French villages, these mixed blood communities, into American towns. But it's still amazing to think, even as late as 1790, something like 95% of the U.S. population was still right there on the Atlantic seaboard.
Wow, 95%. That really puts it in perspective.
Then comes the game changer. The Louisiana Purchase in 1803. Suddenly, the country doubles in size, on paper at least.
Yeah.
And it just ignites the imagination. Thomas Jefferson, who was all about expansion, immediately sends Lewis and Clark out. Go explore the Missouri, find its source, get to the Pacific.
And that expedition, that was huge, wasn't it? Their reports back.
Oh, absolutely transformative. 2 years they were gone. The detailed reports they brought back, they unveiled this continent of, like, immense potential. It really got people thinking.
So Lewis and Clark kind of set the stage. Were there other big expeditions right after that kept that momentum going?
Definitely. Zebulon Pike is another key figure. He led important trips, one towards Santa Fe around 1806, another looking for the Mississippi sources. Coming right after Lewis and Clark, these expeditions just showed how intensely focused the young nation was on the West, on prosperity, on expansion. The reports, especially Lewis and Clark's, about vast resources, untapped potential, that was like pouring fuel on the fire.
Okay, but let's pause here because this is really important. While these expeditions were discovering these lands for the U.S., it's crucial to remember they weren't empty, not at all. Beyond the Mississippi, these were territories already full of people, right?
Absolutely critical point. The whole empty wilderness idea is just a myth. You had established Spanish settlements in New Mexico, Taos, Santa Fe, with farming, mining, going back centuries. And all across the continent, you had incredibly diverse Native American tribes. The Blackfeet, the Crow, Flathead, Shoshone, Ute up in the mountains, the Mandan, the Arikara along the rivers. I mean, countless groups, each with their own complex societies, governments, economies, arts, ways of life.
So when the Americans started moving in, they were stepping into worlds that were already functioning, already vibrant.
Exactly. And like you said earlier, the interactions were complex. You saw real cultural exchange, but also, unfortunately, devastating conflict. That's the story of westward expansion, really.
Before things really ramped up, were there earlier interactions, kind of like test cases for how these cultures might meet?
Yeah, you could call them test interactions, moments that really show the possibilities and the challenges of cultures meeting.
I read about Alexander Henry, the English fur trader. His story seems pretty amazing in that context.
Oh, Henry's story is incredible. He was there right as French control was ending. And at one point, during a massacre of Englishmen by some tribes, a Chippewa man named Wawatam, who Henry knew from trading. Well, Wawatam basically claimed Henry as his brother, saved his life, protected him, hid him from war parties. Wawatam's wife even hid Henry under some birch bark containers in a garret. It shows this possibility for, you know, real human connection across cultures.
Wow. And Henry didn't just get saved. He actually lived with Wawatam's family for a while.
He did, for quite some time. He participated in their daily life, their rituals. He wrote about this amazing bear feast ceremony. They apologized to the bear they killed, dressed its head up with trinkets, smoke pipes. Henry even had to blow smoke into the bear's nostrils to, like, appease its spirit. This is this vivid example of someone becoming deeply immersed, learning survival skills, building real bonds.
That kind of deep immersion, learning from indigenous people, that leads us right to the mountain men, doesn't it? They were kind of doing something similar, but maybe on a larger scale for westward expansion.
Exactly. The mountain men were precisely that kind of intermediary figure.
Mm.
Absolutely essential. They figured out how to survive largely by watching and living with Native Americans. Many married Native American women, adopted customs, learned bits of languages enough for trade, usually. They became these, well, living bridges between the incoming American world and the existing Native world. Vital for navigating those lands.
And this was all happening as the fur trade was really taking off, right? Which wasn't exactly new to North America.
No, not new at all. The French, Spanish, British, Russians, they'd been trapping furs for years. Back in Europe, beaver populations were plummeting. They'd been hunted almost to extinction, so the demand was high.
But for the Americans, what really kicked it into high gear?
Lewis and Clark again. The reports after 1803, they described the headwaters of the Missouri River as being, and this is a quote, richer in beaver and otter than any country on earth.
Mm.
Reports like that. That's what drew that first wave of American mountain men west. It sparked a whole new frontier economy.
Okay, so you've got this potential gold rush, but with furs. How did they organize? Was it just every man for himself?
Well, initially they formed these trapping parties called brigades. Mm. You'd literally see ads in St. Louis papers. William Ashley's famous one in 1822 called for 100 enterprising young men. That led to the Ashley Henry Fur Company, which drew in a lot of the really famous names. Manuel Lisa had started his Missouri Fur Company even earlier, around 1807.
But it wasn't easy going. These brigades ran into serious trouble, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. They faced fierce resistance.
Yeah.
Huge losses, especially from tribes like the Blackfeet. It led to what some historians call a bloody 25-year war. The Blackfeet were smart about it, too. Their policy was basically, traders, fine, we'll protect them, treat them well. Trappers, never. They saw the difference between trade partners and people coming to take resources from their land. It wasn't just random violence. It was strategic defense of their homeland.
And there were specific incidents, attacks.
Yes, definitely. The Arikara, for instance, attacked Ashley's group in 1823. Killed 14 men, wounded 11. A lot of early ventures just failed because of this resistance.
So the brigade system, sending large groups out, that wasn't really working long term. They needed a different plan.
Exactly. And that's where the rendezvous system comes in. This is the innovation from about 1825 to 1840. These were annual summer gatherings, part trade fair, part massive party. Mountain men would come down from the mountains after months, sometimes a year of trapping, trade their furs for supplies, guns, traps, whiskey, tobacco, beads.
Sounds like quite a scene after months of isolation.
Oh, it was wild. Imagine it. Horse races, shooting contests, wrestling, fighting, storytelling, a lot of drinking. The Wild West's first big annual blowout.
Were Native Americans involved in these rendezvous?
Hugely involved. They were incredibly multicultural events. Thousands of indigenous people, Crow, Flathead, Shoshone, Nez Perce, others would come to trade, socialize, negotiate. It was a crucial hub for exchanging goods, information, culture. Then after a week or two of chaos, everyone scattered back to the mountains.
But this whole era, the mountain man era, driven by beaver fur, it didn't last forever. What happened?
Well, a couple of big things. One was fashion, believe it or not. Over in Europe, silk hats started becoming more popular than beaver felt hats. Apparently, a new process came out of China. It sounds small, but that shift in fashion across the ocean had a massive impact back on the American frontier. Demand for beaver pelts just plummeted.
Wow. Global markets affecting guys trapping in the Rockies.
Exactly. And the other major factor was, well, they just trapped too many beavers. Overhunting seriously depleted the populations. There just weren't enough left to make it profitable anymore.
Which then led them to shift to hunting buffalo for hides, right? And we know how that tragically ended for the buffalo herds later on.
Yes, that shift happened. And it ultimately led to the near extinction of the buffalo by the 1870s. Mm-hmm. The whole economic engine of the mountain man era basically sputtered out.
Okay, so the fur trade declined, but the impact these men had, it went way beyond just furs, didn't it? Especially in terms of geography, finding routes.
Oh, immensely. Their contribution to geographic discovery and mapping is huge, maybe even more significant than the official expeditions in some ways. They weren't setting out to map, but in their relentless search for beaver streams, they explored and learned every nook and cranny of the West.
Let's talk specifics. John Coulter, he was one of Lewis and Clark's men originally, right?
Yeah, Coulter. His solo journey in the winter of 1807-1808 is legendary. He crossed the Wind River Range, saw Jackson Hole, crossed the Tetons. And he was the first white man known to have seen the geothermal wonders of Yellowstone.
And that story, Coulter's run, it's almost unbelievable. Stripped naked by Blackfeet, escaping and running hundreds of miles barefoot.
Yeah, something like 300 miles in 11 days, naked through prickly pear cactus. It's an insane story of endurance. Just shows what these guys were capable of surviving.
Yeah.
Makes you feel a bit soft complaining about traffic.
No kidding. What about Jedediah Smith? He made some key discoveries too.
Jedediah Smith, yes. In 1824, he found South Pass. This was massive. It was a wide, relatively easy gap through the Rockies, through the Continental Divide, the key that unlocked overland travel for wagons later on. He also blazed a trail clear across modern Utah. That route basically became the Mormon Corridor, and today it's pretty much Interstate 15. His travels laid the groundwork for mass migration.
And Jim Bridger, another big name.
Bridger famously discovered the Great Salt Lake in 1824, tasted the water, thought he'd reached an arm of the Pacific Ocean because it was so salty. He also found Bridger's Pass, another important route used by the Oregon Trail, now Interstate 80.
So it wasn't just these isolated finds. Collectively, they were basically mapping the whole Northwest.
Pretty much. Through their day-to-day wanderings, they pieced together the map of the entire northwestern United States. The trails they followed, often animal trails or native paths, first became the routes for wagon trains, then railroads, and yeah, even our modern interstates. Their knowledge of the land, the water sources, the weather, it was essential information passed on to the waves of pioneers who came after.
So what was it actually like to be one of these guys? What was the day-to-day? They have this iconic image.
They definitely do. Buckskin clothes, moccasins, maybe a fur hat. Often a small mustache, interestingly, because some tribes distrusted men with full beards, apparently called them dog face sometimes, and they carried their possibles pouch crammed with everything they might possibly need.
Yeah.
Flint and steel for fire, a powder horn, maybe some basic tools, lead for bullets.
And the trapping itself, what did that involve?
Hard work. They'd usually set maybe half a dozen to a dozen traps a day, wade into icy streams, set the traps underwater near beaver dens, often using beaver scent, castoreum, as bait. Some actually tried a kind of basic game management, trying to target male beavers to leave the females, though that wasn't always the case, especially with different groups.
And diet. I've read some pretty rough accounts.
Yeah, diet was basic and often grim, mostly meat, sometimes eaten green, like still warm from the kill. Or if they couldn't cure it properly, it might be borderline rotten. They'd make soup from thistle roots. And they drank something called buffalo cider, which was literally the fluid from a killed buffalo's stomach. You drank what you could find, usually just one big meal a day after all the work was done.
Good grief. Other dangers, just constant, right, from every direction.
Relentless danger. The environment itself, brutal heat, sub-zero cold, starvation, dehydration always looming, and zero medical care. A simple infection, a broken bone, that could easily be a death sentence.
Plus the human element.
Right. Constant threat from some hostile tribes, like we mentioned, the Blackfeet, the Arikara, who raided, stole horses, killed trappers, encroaching on their territory.
Yeah.
And honestly, violence among the trappers themselves wasn't uncommon either. It was a pretty lawless environment. That British author Ruxton, he wrote, they'd destroy human as well as animal life with as little scruple as they exposed their own.
Pretty harsh.
And animals. Grizzlies, wolves. Oh, yeah. Grizzly bears were a major threat. Huge animals, up to 1,000 pounds. Plenty of stories of terrifying close calls. Wolves, snakes. One guy, Ross Cox, wrote about waking up with a bear literally leaning over him in his little shelter trying to get at him.
And some individuals seem to embody that extreme existence even more than others, like old Bill Williams.
Right, figures like old Bill Williams become legendary even among the legends, known for being incredibly independent, a loner, spending winters alone with the Utes, but also a darker side, accusations of betraying native friends, even rumors of cannibalism after one disastrous expedition. It shows the extremes, this wild freedom, but also the brutal things people did to survive.
So what kind of person chooses that life? What was the mindset?
It had to be this incredibly stubborn, independent spirit, a real love for the wilderness, maybe, and just this fierce determination. They talked about trapping wherever we pleased, even if we had to fight for the right. Jedediah Smith, after that near-fatal desert crossing, wrote in his journal something like, "My dreams were not of gold, but of my distant, quiet home of murmuring brooks." Shows that connection to the wild, despite the hardship.
So this is a paradox, isn't it? This, like, boundless freedom, but paired with constant grinding insecurity and danger.
Exactly. Extreme liberty, but at an extreme cost. Self-reliance pushed to its absolute limit.
So summing up, the mountain men left this really extraordinary kind of dual legacy.
Yeah. Definitely. They weren't just trappers chasing furs. They were absolutely essential pathfinders. They mapped huge parts of the continent, providing that crucial geographic knowledge for everyone who followed. And importantly, there were these complex cultural bridges they learned from, lived with, married into, and sometimes fought against diverse indigenous peoples. Their resilience, their individualism, it profoundly shaped the West, physically and culturally.
And those routes they found, those trails they blazed, they were literally the foundation for the next waves of expansion. The pioneers, the wagon trains, the railroads, even today's highways often follow paths they first marked out.
Their knowledge was the bedrock for Manifest Destiny, really. Dictated how and where people could move west.
When you think about it, the sheer physical toughness, the mental fortitude, the constant danger, the isolation, all in pursuit of this idea of wild freedom.
It really makes you stop and think, doesn't it?
It does. And it leaves us with a question for you listening. Reflecting on everything they faced, do you think you possess the mindset, the skills, the raw survival instinct it would take to truly be a mountain man? Something to ponder from the untamed past.